Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:40 p.m. That is Central Time, and today is November 19th, and I thought we'd kick off with Bitcoin. The price is up about $296, but it was below the psychological $57,000 area earlier on today. So I've been talking about Bitcoin over the course of the last few weeks because we had the downside key reversal 2 weeks ago. And that signaled a short-term failed upside break, and it greatly enhanced the potential that we'd come back down and test the lower side of the range, which is exactly what's happening today. So the price is closing right at the lower side of the range. It's in the region of the 50-day moving average as well. And the big question now is whether this is a buying opportunity. Are we at the lower side of the range, or are we going to see this breakdown persist? Because the price dropped below 57,000 yesterday night, then it opened around it this morning, dropped below it, now it's back above it. I thought that 57,000 would be an area where we would anticipate some stops, but it looks like we're starting to see some demand coming through in the region of the 50-day moving average. I think perhaps it might be advisable to just put that on there for just illustrations purposes. The other big thing that we also had in here this week was the sale of a copy of the US Constitution, and the anticipated guide for it was around 15 to possibly 20 million, but then the large number of people in the crypto community got the idea into their heads that they might be able to gain enough money in a short period of time to put together a syndicate and to buy it as part of a DAO, which is a DAO. And basically what a DAO is that it's a hybrid between an NFT and purchasing something via smart contract on the blockchain. So basically what it would do is that it's a further iteration of the kinds of exploratory programs and projects that are currently going on in the crypto world. Now, it would be very easy to simply dismiss them all and say that this is evidence of a super large bubbly environment. But I think it's important to highlight, particularly when we're thinking about it being Friday and the big picture, long-term audio and video. Well, we have to pay attention to some of the characteristics that accompany every big bull market. And eventually, big bull markets, the very biggest bull markets, will eventually climax in bubbly activity, and eventually they will crash. But the most important thing is that bubbles inflate on a wave of enthusiasm, but also they make big promises. And the most important thing is that the promises actually come true. So when we think about the evolution of the of Japan, for example, in the 1980s. Well, their big claim to fame was that their management style was better than everybody else's. And in many respects it was, and it was pretty much adopted by everyone else. So they lost their competitive advantage. And in between there was a massive bubble. And it subsequently popped, and the economy there has been in a deflationary environment since, with a couple of brief flurries in between. Then we had the TMT bubble in the 1990s, so telecoms, media, and technology. And that was all on the back of the introduction of the internet. And the big promise there was that disintermediation and cutting out of the middleman would revolutionize the global economy, and that we would all be spending our time on our email and surfing the web, and that it would eat up all different kinds of brick-and-mortar businesses. And that's exactly what happened. And we had a massive bull market and a massive crash in between. And yet, it was subsequent to the crash that we saw lots of new business models actually reaching commercial utility. And it was as we started to see the mobile applications of the internet being adopted with 4G and rapid access to the internet on the go. That was one of the really massive transformative effects of the internet, which has led to the current significant bull market. Well, then let's just think about what are the promises that are being made in the cryptocurrency world. Well, one of the promises is that we're going to have truly democratic access to credit and capital, and that there won't be any need for intermediaries. But I think that's there is obviously then a marketing component to that. If we think about how I've been thinking a lot about how this works in terms of Switzerland's approach to referenda. So they have lots of different referendums on an annual basis, and some of them can be over trivial things, and some can be rather important. But in order to sway a sufficiently large portion of the electorate, well, then it's the better funded and the bigger campaigns have a greater chance of attracting the critical mass necessary to input change. And those that don't, or that are trivial, well, then they don't successfully create change. Well, if you're in an environment where decisions about an asset are based upon a democratic vote, well, then in many respects, it just seems like it's going to be more about activist investors and their impact on company boards, except that they'll need more wherewithal to influence the democratic aligned way of thinking. So that's how the DAO's system works. Then when we think about NFTs, well, it makes sense at least that if you're the creator of an asset, whether that is in terms of art or anything else, that when you transfer ownership, that you might be able to hold on to some kind of royalty, because actors can do that. They believe that the kind of work that they perform is artistic in nature, and when they sell it in terms of getting paid to participate in a movie or a TV show, well, whenever that movie gets shown again, they tend to get a cut of the profits. And musicians, they sell basically subscriptions to their music, because every time it's played somewhere, they get a royalty from it. But artists, in the form of physical expression, like just in different media, whether that is online or in the physical world, they have no way of ensuring they have a royalty. So the NFT system is going to provide that. Now, the extraordinary enthusiasm for what can only be described as trivial factors, like people selling pictures of monkeys or any number of cats, well, they're not all eventually going to have value as pieces of art, but the system will eventually allow artists to have a royalty factor, and that's a very significant innovation, and it is going to help to attract greater interest from the creative community, and it creates a business model which will sustain more creative people. So that's potentially a very significant advance. But it doesn't necessarily mean that we can't have extraordinary valuations for anything. And it's certainly helping, for example, that copy of the Constitution sold for over $40 million. So it went for double the reserve price, or the upper end of the reserve price, and a lot of that was because of enthusiasm from the cryptocurrency world. But of course, also it's because of low interest rates and a massive incentive by investors to try and lock down physical assets. Well, it's also quite likely that we're going to see the securitization of an increasingly large proportion of the global economy. And this is, I think, quite likely. If we go back and think about what happened in terms of the South Sea bubble, the South Sea Company was set up because they were able to get exclusive rights to supply slaves to the South Sea and then ultimately to Latin America, to South America. And they thought that that was guaranteed income, and they were able to sell shares off the back of it, and people thought it was just money for old rope, so they thought it couldn't possibly lose money, and they extremely inflated the price. And it went up, and then it came all the way back down. And arguably, the change that was wrought from that was to make a lot of people feel very sour about the slave trade, and perhaps it wasn't altogether a coincidence that within less than 100 years, slavery was completely outlawed in the British Empire. So certainly, we can think about the promises and the effects of various big bull markets in lots of different contexts. Now, when we think about what's the real promise of Bitcoin, it's that it offers a supply inelastic solution to transferring money and store of value around the world. And it's quite likely that at some point in the future there will be digital currencies, because we're in a fiat currency world right now. And we're going to remain in a fiat currency world for as long as it takes there to be a real big problem with money. And we're not there yet. But obviously, there is an awful lot of money floating around. And we've had this extraordinary growth in the size of central bank balance sheets over the course of the last year. But the one thing that I think is important to highlight, it's that when we look at the size of central bank balance sheets, and they might have gone up by 50% in 2020, but they went up by 50% in 2008 as well. So we have two instances of central banks around the world printing money with abandon during a time of crisis. And then let's ask ourselves, has anything really changed? Has anything occurred to suggest that central banks will not continue to follow this exact same course of action the next time there's a problem? Because the one thing they're terrified of is asset price deflation. The last thing they want is to see the price of property come down and stay down, like, for example, happened in Japan. The last thing they want is the price of wages to come down. They're terrified of deflation. They're terrified of people not wanting to continue to spend. Now, I think that when we think about what's going on in terms of inflation right now, one of the clearest forms of inflation is precautionary spending. And that arguably is exactly what people are doing. They're buying now because they're worried that the price of whatever it is they're buying is going to be higher in future. And they have got a rationale for thinking about that because geopolitical tensions continue to rise, and they're worried about supply disruptions. So people are accelerating purchases, and not least because they're flush with cash following a year in which more than half of the population earned more from unemployment benefits than they did from working. So not only are people accelerating purchases, but they have the money to spend. So it's a good time to accelerate those purchases. I think as we look at what investors are thinking about, there's a large proportion of people who've been in the industry for quite a long time are worried about bubbly valuations. And we've had really quite extraordinary moves in terms of the valuations we've had. So when we think then about what's going on in the wider world, well, I thought it would be interesting to look at some constituents. So I pulled down some data just to think about the free cash flow yield. So Rocket Mortgages has a free cash flow yield of negative 1162%. DD Global, which SoftBank pulled a fast one and got it over the line in terms of its IPO, has got a negative cash flow of a negative cash flow yield of 81%. And Carnival Corp, because of the significant challenges that they're having in getting back to business, are still losing money. And Avis Budget has running a cash flow yield negative of 32%. Now, when we start stacking that up, when you look at the extraordinary move that Avis has had in the last while, where the price went from 100 to 350 in a record pace of time, and this vertical advance pulled back sharply, but it didn't collapse, and the price is starting to firm again. So that's really rather extraordinary. And anyone who's looking for just evidence of bubbly activity doesn't really have far to go. There's lots of companies that don't make any money, and they continue to do exceptionally well. And we can think about AMC. And my family and I went back to the cinema for the first time in 2 years last week, and I really what we'll probably be doing is any movies that we want to see that don't end up on streaming services, we might go and see them, but we'll still prefer to stay at home and watch movies on streaming services. And yet AMC is trading at prices that are above where they were in 2016. So these kinds of things don't make logical sense. And when we think about the other big characteristic of major bull markets, one is that they make these big promises, and the promises do come true, but not nearly in the time that people want. But then the other major characteristic of major bull markets and bubbly activity is the tolerance for contradiction. And it's something that we see in every mania. So one of the big contradictions, and it was exactly the same in the 1990s, it's that earnings don't matter. And when you have companies with price to sales ratios where they are right now, well, then we have to conclude that we're in an environment where earnings don't matter. I thought it would be also interesting to look at the price to sales ratio for companies, but particularly to look at it relative to what the average for the price to sales ratio is. Because it's one thing to point out that price to sales ratios are high. I think it's quite another to look at what they've been over the last 5 years and then see which one is higher. So Intellia Therapeutics has a price to sales ratio of 331 times. And that's more than double the 5-year average for the share. Now, they have the trademark for the CRISPR technology. At least they're the company that seems to be coming out on top in terms of that. And they've got some licensing agreements in terms of how it's used. But the reality is that the technology is moving along. There are different ways of sequencing and editing genetic data. It's not all going to use CRISPR, and the technology is increasing at or improving at a rapid pace. So one would have to conclude that we've seen prices go up in an just really extraordinary manner. And then, of course, Nvidia, which accelerated again in here this week, is trading on a price to sales ratio of 33 times, which is more than 50% higher than the 5-year average. But MSCI is trading on a price to sales ratio of 28 times. So these are really high values. And if one is looking for evidence of bubbly activity, well, again, you just don't really have to look all that far. And thinking about the ability of these companies to make back their valuation, well, it is, I think, it's just a matter of time before they run out of runway. But it's one thing to identify bubbly activity. It's quite another to say that it's over. So I think it's much more important to highlight the factors that would contribute to a top forming. Ultimately, there will be a top, and when the top eventually does form, there are a significant number of these companies are going to zero. And obviously, it's important then to pay attention to not only how big the bubble is or how much bigger it's likely to get, but what are the contributing factors that might lead to it, in fact, going back down again. Well, I think the most important is interest rates. And we've had a lot of volatility in the government bond yields over the course of the last couple of months. They've been up and down quite a bit over the last 6 months, and they're still holding the region of the 200-day moving average. And the yield was down by about 5 basis points in here today. And we're right in the region of the lower side of the overhead trading range. And you need to look at lots of back history to really appreciate just how lengthy this range is. And we know that the cost of servicing the government bond debt is extraordinary. And the higher yields go, the more expensive it's going to be. And I think it's interesting that central banks continually talk about the need to normalize policy. And one really does have to ask the question how on earth they're going to achieve that. Because as we know, valuations are very high. And if they were to seriously normalize policy, well, then they would be looking at a significant recession. And that's the last thing they want. So they're going to be extremely reticent to raise interest rates. But that's not stopping them from talking about it. And the first thing that they're going to do is taper. So they're underway with the taper, and tapering is going on in places like Australia and Canada as well. And Australia is a good example of somewhere where they're again doing a good job of talking about raising rates, but they're not doing it. And Canada is in an environment as well where you have this natural disaster in Vancouver, where the city was completely isolated for 3 or 4 days because of heavy rains. And it's a natural disaster. There's going to have to be reconstruction of railway lines, of bridges, and you're getting food airdropped into the city. So if the Bank of Canada is looking for an excuse to hold off on any further tightening, well, they now have it. So all of these factors are contributing to an environment where it's going to be difficult for central banks to raise rates. Now, then we also have the fiscal side. And the most important thing about the fiscal side is not so much that the size of the accommodation that we had last year isn't going to be repeated. And obviously, governments can't continue to spend 18% of GDP per annum. But global deficits are running at about 2.3 trillion, and that number is continuing to trend higher. And the US government announced last week or 10 days ago that they're going to spend almost $1 trillion on infrastructure. And now they're looking at spending another $1.5 trillion and change on a Build Back Better program, which is going to massively boost social spending. And God only knows what it's going to look like once the senators have had their go at it. But at the moment, it's going to hand quite a significant amount of money to the people that traditionally buy stocks. So that's a good part of the reason why the stock market remains reasonably firm. And then, of course, we have the wild cards like the coronavirus, and that hasn't gone away. Pfizer continues to be the company that's doing best from it. And the share was up in a dynamic manner this week. So they're looking at preserving the intellectual property around their dosage. They've delivered, or they're developing, not only injections but also pills against the coronavirus. And it keeps coming back, and often with sufficient vigor to cause lockdowns. And Europe is locking down again, and Germany has cancelled Christmas again. And I remember when we lived in Ireland, we used to really enjoy going off to Germany for the Weihnachtsmarkt, and my kids and wife really enjoyed those trips. So, I can imagine that people in Germany really miss them. Well, the euro, having rebounded yesterday, and it looked like it was primed to unwind its short-term oversold condition, completely unwound that bounce in here today, and on the back of these lockdowns. Now, we can also look at the hospital admittances for COVID in the west of the USA, east of the Rockies, and it's ramping higher. So there is the potential that a whole range of boosters are going to be required, and that this might turn into an annual or even a semi-annual affair. So that we're going to be looking at boosters for these vaccine shots on a sustained basis. And that's also going to inhibit central banks from raising rates. So when we think then about the bubbly activity that we have, well, obviously central banks are beginning to worry about it, but they're inhibited from doing anything about it. And that's a good part of the reason why gold remains reasonably firm. So the price was down about $11 in here today, and it's pausing here in the region of the sequence of lower rally highs over the last 15 or 16 months. But it is back above the trend mean, and as long as it's holding that $1,800 area, we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. The one thing that I think is important to highlight is that we've had a distinct absence of big downward dynamics, and it doesn't mean that we can't have them, but at the moment we're not getting them. And at previous peaks during this downtrend from the peak in August of 2020, every time it's rallied, it's come rattling back down. And so far, it's easing back down, which would suggest that we're back in a demand-dominated environment, and that this is probably not much more than some consolidation overall. If we then think about the other big lightning rods for evidence of liquidity starting to abate, well, high yield spreads would be one of those. Now, the spread is definitely stabilizing, but it's stabilizing in the region of all-time lows. So nobody's going to be worried about any kind of problem in high yield until it is trending through 500 basis points. In other words, high yield spreads would need to double in order to be any kind of signal that we're looking at a problem in the credit markets. Now, it's reasonable to anticipate that we're going to have a problem in the credit markets eventually, because right now private equity companies are falling over themselves to issue debt and to use that debt to pay themselves big dividends. So KKR, for example, issued a pile of debt just this week from, I think it's Renewable Energy Venture, and they're going to pay themselves a dividend of over $1 billion. And they can do that because investors are absolutely desperate for yield. So if they can sell that debt and lock it in, and if the investors buying it are locking in those returns, well, they'll be happy for as long as the companies stay afloat. Of course, the more indebted these companies become, because they're not issuing the debt as to supplement retained earnings, they're not reinvesting in their companies, and the private equity companies are just basically looting the businesses and using this as an opportunity to do that. Well, ultimately, these companies are going to be more fragile. It means that we're going to have even more zombie companies, but we're not going to have that become a problem until they have a need for refinancing. And the one thing that happened in the course of the last 12 months was that there was a massive pace of refinancing. So when we think about problems in the debt market, the problem in the US debt market is somewhere out there in the future. It could be anywhere from 3 to 5 years from now, because a lot of the debt that was issued during the pandemic will mature with probably around a 3-year to 5-year time horizon. Whereas what we're looking at in China right now is a massive refunding requirement in 2022. So, China Evergrande started to stabilize in here today. When we think about, for example, Greenland, their 20 Greenland. Well, let me get the name of the company correct, but their yield peaked around 70%. It's now down to 30%. So there's a substantial rally going on right now in some of these property developer bonds because the Chinese government is starting to ease up. And the reason they're easing up is because there is this massive refinancing demand impending in 2022. The last thing that they want is a large number of property developers going bust during the exact same time that the opening ceremony for the Beijing Olympics starts in February. So they're right now starting to move to help to support the property developers. That's also helping to support the banks, and it's helping the stock market to steady. But what it also helps to highlight is that there's more money flowing, and that the credit impulse in China is starting to turn back upwards. So we've had a significant correction in the property markets, and now the government is starting to ease up on rules about the land sales by local governments. So that's helping the credit impulse to turn around. So this is an additional source of significant new money coming into the global market, and capital is both global and mobile. So we have Japan, where they're devaluing their currency, and they have absolutely no intention of raising rates or abandoning their central bank bond buying programs, and the central bank already owns most of the domestic bond market or JGB market already. So Japan is not going to raise rates. Europe is worried about inflation, can't do anything about it. China doesn't want to have a property market crash, so they have to supply additional liquidity. And the USA is talking a good game about raising rates and normalizing policy, but is going to find that it's a very difficult prospect. And central banks are only half the equation because governments around the world have no intention of running on a balanced budget program, and they're quite willing to run deficits indefinitely. So That's helping to support the stock market. And until those conditions change, then we're likely to continue to see additional upside. Now, the Nasdaq is in still a consistent advance, and the primary consistency of the trend since the low in March of 2020 is these ranges, one above another. And each of the ranges is relatively similar sized, and a reaction of more than 1,000 points, and a pullback into the underlying ranges would be required to question the consistency of the advance. And a consistent trend is a trend in motion. So if this trend is to persist, then it would we can or what we would anticipate it to do would be to surge higher from here, and then perhaps get up to 18,000 and pull back by 1,000, or get up to 17,000, pull back by 1,000, find support above the 15,700 level, range for approximately 2 months, and then break out again. And as long as it's continuing to do that, well, then we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. The Nasdaq has been by far the best performing index over the course of the last 12 years. So it's the one to pay particular attention to. And of course, it's been significantly dominated by eight large companies. So when we look at the performance of these companies and just add together their market caps, it's still in a steep uptrend. And the eight companies, Facebook, Apple, Netflix, Google, Microsoft, Amazon, Nvidia, and Tesla, have a combined market cap today of 12.3 trillion. This, I think, is the most important chart in the world right now, and it is their relative performance compared to the wider market represented by the market cap of the NYSE. And sorry, I didn't type in the correct ticker. So as long as this trend is still going up and it hit a new closing high in here today, as long as this trend is keep going up, well, then we would have to conclude that this bull market and this bubbly environment is still inflating. And with the rise in the number of coronavirus cases and the transition back towards the potential for lockdowns in Europe and potentially in portions of America, then demand for stay-at-home investments are probably going to be greater. So it suggests that we're going to have more refocusing back into these large caps, and that this bull market is going to take another big leg higher. So that would further inflate valuations, and price-to-sales ratios will get even more egregious. And it will put even greater pressure on central banks because there's nothing that happens as a result of that is going to improve their ability to raise rates and normalize policy. So we're still in a liquid environment. We're still in an environment where asset prices are appreciating. And we have these markets, particularly in the NFT sector, where there is money being sprayed around. So obviously that's representative of bubbly activity. But until we actually see something occur to inhibit the significant increase in additional liquidity, well, then we're still going to see asset prices appreciate. Now, one of the things beyond central banks that can have a significant effect and cause recessions would be a surge in oil prices. Oil today was down $2.50, and the USA is talking about releasing supply from the Strategic Reserve. And if they do that, it will bring prices back down. There is just no questioning of that. But the bigger point is, ultimately, that strategic reserve will have to be refilled. And if they bring prices back down, well, then they'll have to start refilling it, which means they'll have to start buying more. But it would also imply that supply would have to increase. And of course, if the price comes back down, well, then particularly the non-OPEC portion of the market will be making less money. So if they do release supply from the strategic reserve and other countries are encouraged to do the same, well, what that would do is create the conditions for a supply inelasticity environment in future. It might even contribute to a pop on the upside and a significant appreciation in oil prices in future. But in between now and then, there's the potential that prices will come back down. And now that the price is below $80, it might be failing at this level, and it could enhance the potential that we're going to see prices come back down into the region of the 200-day moving average. And that's just on the back of talk about releasing inventory from strategic reserves. If they in fact do that, we could anticipate that prices would come back more than the 200-day moving average. And of course, that would remove a tax on consumption from a lot of people. It would remove some of the angst about inflationary pressures. And it would also help the cost of production for a large number of metals, particularly gold miners. So what happens in terms of oil is going to be important. We're definitely seeing that copper prices have been subject to a great deal of volatility of late. The price is rebounding from the region of the trend mean today, and it was up pretty substantially off the lows. So copper is used in every country in the world, and China is the largest consumer. So it has a great deal of sway on what happens in terms of the price because of that consumption trend. But the further willingness to electrify more of the global economy is, or it represents a significant use case for more copper. And as the solar sector starts to turn around, and as the wind sector starts to turn around, and generally the renewable energy sector has perked up this week, copper is also starting to pop on the upside. It's been a 6-month consolidation in the region of the upper side of this lengthy base formation. And I do think that this new bull market for commodities is going to be led by copper. The reality is that there hasn't been successful bringing to market of significant copper resources. And it takes longer to bring a new world-class copper resource to market than it does for oil. And this is going to contribute to a supply and elasticity environment for the foreseeable future because there's no new big investments being made in new supply because of the ESG delays that are occurring. It's just increasingly difficult to get these projects permissioned. So, as the deployment of electrification in the transportation sector and in the energy sector really starts to pick up, then we're likely to see a secular bull market in copper. And that can continue regardless of what happens with oil prices. So, we're in, I think, a very interesting environment because valuations are high, and valuations have been high for a long time. And they're higher today than they were at any point before the pandemic, and it's quite likely that they'll get higher. The reality is that high valuations are not a timing tool. And it's really only a question of how long does it take for central banks to be forced into action. And that doesn't look to be apparent in the short term, which would suggest that we are likely to see the stay-at-home technology type companies continue to outperform in this environment. Of course, there are some very big promises being made. And the promises in the technology sector range from autonomous vehicles, and Apple is increasingly being rumored to be working on an autonomous vehicle, and the share broke out to a new high in here this week. Well, quite whether it's Apple or Google or Tesla eventually designs and develops and delivers an autonomous vehicle, the promise has been made. It's really only a question of when it's delivered upon, and the market will price in that eventuality well before it is in fact delivered. And then we can think about nuclear. Well, Bill Gates and Warren Buffett are building a molten salt reactor in Wyoming, and that will help to pioneer the sector because there's been a lot of talk about it for the last decade, and the relative benefits of it compared to older designs, and the non-proliferation aspect of those designs is particularly attractive when we come to thinking about how we're going to power the entire world without carbon. So these are the promises that are being made that it can be done, and ultimately it will be done, and it will probably take 20, if not 30 years to get up to a point where it really makes a difference. But it's quite likely that the future of the nuclear sector is going to be very bright indeed, and it's only beginning to be priced in right now. We can think about the promise of hypersonic travel and SpaceX's BFR. Well, this is going to be the largest rocket launched in decades, and then reusable on top of that. So the relative cost of lifting new payloads into orbit is going to go down, and go down by orders of magnitude. And of course, that will greatly enhance the potential for a true space-based economy. So, and as those costs come down, the kinds of things that will be possible, everything from living in space to manufacturing in space, will become realizable. And of course, these are the promises that are being made. Then those promises will be delivered upon. And the valuations attached to these promises, well, they're probably going to reach even higher levels than space itself before it eventually pops and dies down. And then we can think about the same thing in terms of the promises that are being made in the cryptocurrency world, that it will revolutionize the financial sector, and that it will disintermediate the banks. And that's quite likely, that there is a place for blockchains and crypto in the global financial architecture. I remain very much of the view that the architecture is useful independently of the value of the tokens. I still don't really get why we need to have the tokens. The infrastructure itself will eventually disappear. And just like we used to pay for our Encarta, we used to pay for AOL online, and now we pay for wire transfers, and we pay for these tokens, and we pay for transactions in a minimal case, and then we wait in terms of time. All of that will eventually disappear, and the crypto world will basically exist in the background, and we'll use it without knowing it. That's what we do with the financial architecture such as it is today, and that's ultimately how the cryptocurrency world will exist as well. That doesn't mean that the value of the tokens can't go up and down, and they're likely to go up and then go down, and the vast majority of tokens that are in existence today will disappear. And yet the likelihood is that the innovations that are being created today and the enthusiasm of the idealists that are doing it will eventually create change and deliver on many of the promises. Obviously, it doesn't mean that the central banks of the world are going to adopt Bitcoin as the one true currency. I think that is just too much to ask. But the attractions of digital currencies from the perspective of central banks are really powerful. I think it's quite likely that ultimately the size of the debts, the size of the valuation expansion, the fact that the one thing that we did not have with the pandemic panic was that property prices went up, not down. And that insulated the global economy and leverage from a really big readjustment. One of the big problems with the global economy during the financial crisis was that property prices and asset prices went down together. One of the reasons why the tech bubble burst and didn't have a knock-on effect on the wider economy was because the property prices were unaffected. So if these things go one for the other and we get simultaneous crashes, it would suggest that the next crash, when it does come, will be both property and asset prices, and that there will be debt issues that become significant. And it might then lead to a harder currency environment. And central banks might be encouraged to engage with central bank digital currencies because it gives them more power and visibility about how money flows around. And because the crash that would lead to that is so deleterious to value, and central banks are aware of the size of the debt load, and they're terrified of deflation, but they're even more terrified of a crash. Well, then they're going to do whatever they can to ensure that the music keeps playing. And as long as that remains the case, well, then asset prices can continue higher. And that can persist for years. So, having just had a big mistake and a big crash in the market as a result of the pandemic only a year ago, well, I guess it's a year and a half ago now, it's unlikely that we're going to have another one of those soon. Rather, it's more likely that prices are going to go up well beyond what people anticipate to be rational or reasonable. And when people stop worrying about crashes, well, then that's when they start to become more likely. But the things that we monitor as lead indicators for problems in the future are not flashing. And as long as that remains the case and trends remain consistent, well, then we give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today and wish all the best to all of you.